Blog Talk Radio.
You know there's more to this world than what you're told. Paranormal phenomenon, supernatural forces, government conspiracies, alien visitors. Step out of the world you see, open up your mind, and get ready for another round of strange at the Supernatural Radio Show with Corrine DeWinter and Nino Del Padre. Brought to you by PurplePlates.com for harmony, healing, and living energy products for a greater quality of life. Listen up, world. Here's Corrine and Nino.
Hello and welcome, everyone, on this lovely Friday. And I am joined by the amazing Karen Kay from California. She's going to actually be my co-host today. So I'll bring her on as soon as I see her. I'm not sure where she is. But anyway, I am thrilled to have Julia Asante as my guest tonight. And I've been looking forward to this for so long. Julia is the author of The Last Frontier, Exploring the Afterlife and Transforming Our Fear of Death. Now, I have not finished the book yet. It's a very chunky book full of the most amazing information about life after death and everything that entails. So I just want to give you a little bio on Julia before we bring her on. Julia is both a mystic and a scholar. She has been a professional intuitive and medium for over four decades. She's also an active past life therapist and an all-faith minister. Julia gives workshops in the U.S. and Europe focused on unleashing the full range of people's natural psychic capacities, from remote viewing and healing to reincarnational recall and after-death communication. Her accuracy in telepathy has been clinically tested at Columbia University, which scored her high above other professional psychics. As a scholar, she got her PhD at Columbia University. Her landmark publications on ancient Near Eastern magic, cult, and religion have revised many longstanding assumptions in the study of antiquity in general. She has taught at Columbia, Bryn Mawr, and the University of Munster in Germany, and given talks at many major universities around the world. Currently, she divides her time between the U.S. and Europe. And she's actually calling in from Germany tonight. And her official website, which I'll put in the chat room as well, www.juliaasante.com. And check it out, you guys, her readings. I personally got a reading from Julia, and a friend of mine as well got a reading from her. And it's just really amazing, the readings that she gives. They're so right on and, you know, brings up stuff that just would blow your mind. Okay, Karen, are you there? Okay, maybe she's not. I'm sorry.
I'm here.
Karen, are you there? Hello.
I'm here.
How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. I'm not sure. I wasn't sure what number you were calling in from. But we're going to bring on Julia now. And I know we both have so many questions for her. And so let's bring on the amazing Julia. Hi, Julia. How are you doing?
Hi, amazing Corrine. And Karen, I'm glad you joined.
Yes, I'm excited.
You know, I just corresponded with Karen last week.
Yeah,
a few days ago.
Yeah, I just
found an old email that she sent me a long time ago, way before I met you, and wrote her, and she told me that she was going to be on the show.
Yeah.
So that's great.
It is great. It's a really strange coincidence, but I'm glad it happened.
Yeah.
So, Julia, and thanks for staying up late tonight to talk to us, because I know it's like, midnight at least in Germany.
Yeah, but that's not late for me, so... That's not a problem.
Oh, good, good.
It's the 4 o'clock in the morning interviews that are a problem.
Right. No, I hear you. Yeah. But
yeah.
Good for you for getting up and doing them anyways, because this stuff really needs to be talked about. So the reason you wrote The Last Frontier, if I remember correctly, it was because one of your friends who had passed came to you and sort of urged you to do it. I mean, you can you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah. That's the biggest reference point for all of this for me, the moment where he and I were very close, and he died. I watched the death process. I watched him going in and out of his body. When the paddles were put on his chest, I watched him come back in. The colors had changed, and eventually he just left. He just floated off sideways, by the way. And I avoided him. Any attempts on his part to contact me, I avoided. I was in graduate school. I was handling his family, his estranged wife. I officiated at his funeral. I was just so overwhelmed that I avoided him. And that's when all of the characteristic stuff started in the house. It was a New York City apartment. The door was open in the morning, which is very dangerous. The fax would Twitter. The phone would ring and ring and ring. I'd answer it, and no one was there. It just kept going on, lights blinking. And finally, after more than a week of this, I couldn't resist anymore, and I saw him. It just, this is what happens when people are newly dead. They can be so incredibly clear, and you can get word-for-word communication, and that's what happened with him. And he was brilliant. He was huge, and he was in a panic because no one could hear him, and no one could perceive him, and finally I did it, and the gratitude was overwhelming. You could see little sparks coming off of his etheric body, his energy body. And it started, and that first correspondence went on for about an hour. We laughed, we cried, we argued, we joked, and he set up a lot of little things for me, like I'm going to bring you such and such a flower. By the way, a flower I didn't even like, a red gerbera. And some woman showed up. I don't even like those flowers. And some woman showed up the next day with a little bouquet of little tiny pink roses and said, and for some reason, I needed to buy you this, and it was the red gerbera. And these sorts of proofs went on and on and on. There's so many things that happened. There's a whole choir of kids who were scheduled to sing at Carnegie Hall that evening. I met them on a ferry. And they sang to me a love song that explained all of the questions that I had asked a friend of mine about Michael, this person I'm talking about, answered all the questions that I had about him the night before. And oddly enough, this love song was written, the text was written by William Blake, and it was the text that my now husband felt described love the best and sent to me.
Oh, my God.
a few months after I met him, which is a few months after Michael's death.
Jeez. That is really amazing.
And that's just a few of the things that occurred. It was just... And when you go through an experience like that, and then everybody else showed up too. That was the other thing. I was getting unbelievable amounts of after-death communication from people who have died. I didn't even know were dead, but then knew were dead. And once you go through a period like that, which is a period that's often brought on by high stress, your psychic abilities are accentuated by stress. They serve as reference points where you can never go back and deny the validity of survival after death.
Wow, I didn't realize that stress brought on higher psychic abilities, because I should be Nostradamus right now.
Yeah, well, I think you are. but think of it, the 40 days and the 40 nights in the desert and the stress, the fasting. Think of what some of the American Indian institutions have offered in terms of the sun dance, body mutilations. It goes on and on. It's in every culture.
Wow, okay. Now, a friend of mine who's also a psychic medium, and I know you don't term yourself as a psychic medium, but you are, she said that women going through menopause often become more psychic. So that would make sense, right?
Well, yes. Now, I think that has more to do with the way the ego reorients itself. It starts to turn away from the outside world and the constant demands of it and goes more inward. I mean, there's a lot of changes that go on from during and after menopause, especially with women, because there is a type of male menopause. But where women get to know themselves. They get to accept themselves more. And that's a process of listening to your inner voice. And really, everything that we're doing is about listening to our inner voices. Absolutely mm-hmm. everything. All interdimensional contact, all remote viewing. Remote viewing really is really, we're always remote viewing. They're all anchored in being able to access the inner self, which is what I try to teach.
Right.
Making contact with that in various venues, various paths, through telepathy, through after-death communication, which is largely telepathic but not entirely, et cetera and so forth.
Right. Karen, I think Karen had a question for you.
Well, I just wanted to say how much I like the idea that you talk about your goal being to take fear away from people who are afraid of death, you know, to make it not a scary thing. And I think that's just fantastic. So I just wanted to say that.
The people who are afraid of death comprise probably 99.99% of the human population.
Yeah.
It runs everything that we do, everything we encounter. My husband is downstairs watching people getting murdered on television.
Mm.
That's all about the fear of death.
Mm-hmm.
Right, right. And is it, Julia, I heard once that the fear of death is what really prompts us to get married and have children.
Yeah. That the idea of biological immortality, absolutely. And this was a driving force, a well-known driving force in antiquity, much stronger than it is now, the perpetuation of a family. The power of a family was what was important, or a clan. But I think the marriage institution really started more with domestication of animals and farming, and when we began to get used to the idea of ownership, and therefore marriage was a way of owning another person, and it still is, unfortunately.
Jeez. In your chapter, It's Okay to Talk to the Dead, there's a section, can contact be dangerous? Can you tell us about that?
From the time of Judaic reforms in the 7th century B.C., there has been a fear around after-death communication or speaking with ancestors or dead family members, which was a very common practice all over the ancient world, incredibly common. It was done in every household. During the Christian era, the Old Testament, which forbade after-death communication or mediumship or necromancy, it was called, or is called in the Bible, and was punishable by being stoned to death. When Christianity got hold of that, it became a sin. It became a demonic act. And that's where we are still today. We're still caught up with this idea of a hell of malicious spirits out there trying to get hold of us, of the fear of the unknown, really. But there's nothing you can think of in terms of death and the dead that doesn't have a macabre quality to it. I mean, grave and coffin and casket, funeral, they all are dark. I mean, just even when I say the dead, it brings a certain flavor, let's say, that doesn't quite give you the feeling of lightness and joy that most people experience over there. The only terminology that has been able to penetrate that has been the near-death experience, which is so closely associated with these tunnels and the beings of light, which are actually not all that consistent. The near-death experiences
right.
have been a little bit misrepresented.
Okay, that's interesting. And you go on to say in this chapter, if you feel susceptible to evil, in quotations, you've got some soul searching ahead of you. Now, do you believe, I always ask the people that come on, if I am Hitler and I die, where do I go? Where do you think Hitler went? I'm just pointing to one person that we know to be, you know.
I've never actually been able to locate him. I did do it with Saddam Hussein because
oh.
It was so current. Yes, and because you can do that with remote viewing. You can follow people. And I saw him in such – I was overwhelmed with fear. Let me just say that. And then I realized it was his. And it was as though he was still in that hole where he was originally found, you know, in the floor.
Right.
Incredible fear. Hitler himself, there. I have read from other mediums that he's in some kind of a school. You know,
okay.
Right. The another one that I did was this kid in the Newtown killings.
Oh.
And that was probably the worst agony that I've ever encountered in my life because this kid died, killed himself, and only to discover that he still existed and he couldn't bear it. And the agony was overwhelming.
Oh,
overwhelming.
Man.
And I was told, I watched this whole thing, I watched this whole sequence, and how the children who were not doing well in the afterlife, who were not being taken care of or whatever, how their parents reacted to that because telepathically they knew. It was the parents who were in the highest grief were the ones, the parents of those children who weren't doing well. It was very interesting. But
wow.
this boy, I was told, was because of the power of his emotion, the power of his need for atonement, that he will be an enormous worker from the other side for children.
Wow.
So there really isn't any punishment. There is self-punishment. I've worked with people who believe that they're in hell. They're in hallucinations of their own. And it can take some real work to get them out, believe me, because they don't want to come out. They
right.
don't know there's anything else. They're completely involved with this self-created despair and punishment.
Not even
Hitler. No, not even Hitler. I mean, he was demented. The whole period of time was demented, and a lot of what Hitler was doing was really a follow-up of a lot of stuff that was understood throughout the world. In the imperialistic mentality of superior races that was brought on by Darwin and his wonderful cousin who started the idea of eugenics.
Oh, yeah.
It was a bad time for the human race in terms of hierarchies and superiority. And it was in a growing imperialistic mentality, and Hitler was just perhaps the last wave of that.
Right. Julia, have you ever read the book What Dreams May Come?
No.
Okay,
What did you want to tell me about it?
No, it's a fantastic book. It was written by Richard Matheson, who wrote a bunch of the early Twilight Zones, and he was a fantastic author. Anyway, but that is, you know, I always thought of when we die, like it kind of like in school, if you had that teacher that said, well, at the end of the class or whatever semester, what grade do you think you deserve? And I always like translated that to when we cross over, it's like, what grade do you think you deserve? Oh, I think I deserve to be at this level. You know what I mean?
Fortunately, if that were really true, I would have a lot more problems in the work that I do. But fortunately, most people get it, and it's a very rapid change and shift. You know, this whole thing with this constant judgment, this was also something that started much later than we think, around the 5th century. Maybe a little bit in what we call Middle Kingdom Egypt, it started to show up, this idea of judgment and on a moral basis. But understanding what morality meant then is very different from what morality means today. But before then, there was no concept of sin, really not. You could slight a god if you didn't do the right rituals or you didn't observe or honor a god. You could get into trouble, and you could be afflicted by bad spirits and all of that, which also often had to do with gods. But the idea of sin, no, there wasn't any. There was a kind of judgment in the ancient world, the what we call the netherworld in Mesopotamia. But that was just a social judgment. It was whether laws were being observed, whether social order was kept, and nothing further. So the worst thing that ever happened to us was this invention of sin, and then that we are now, in Christian belief, born with it. Even worse, we're condemned from the beginning.
Right, right. Well, I think it was Teresa of Avila, I'm not sure. I think she said there is no hell. I think she was the one who, you know, argued that there was no such place as hell. Is there a hell, Julia?
Only if you make one for yourself.
Okay.
No, there's no hell, and there's no heaven either. I mean, these kind of terminology, this dualistic terminology has got to go. I mean, you know, truthfully, even what we call the afterlife is totally wrong. It's a word that I increasingly dislike. But it doesn't describe anything. It's a silly word, and it implies that we all dead people go to the same place. Well, obviously, there's no place involved here. It's a state of mind, and it is mixed with other kinds of dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it isn't just dead humans and animals. Animals are there, yeah, don't forget. Animals go and recreate their afterlives in the same way that we do, and they're often together. You know, they're often with your family members, even if they never knew your animals, your pets.
Well,
right.
I routinely see animals for people I work with. And often they're an animal from their childhood. It's a scream.
Right. That's cool, you know.
It is.
Karen,
it's
what were
lovely.
You going to say?
Oh, I just wondered along those lines if there are other dimensions. Are there other types of beings in other dimensions? Are there angels, for instance, or you know, lesser critters?
Angels being what kind of greater critters?
Yeah, critters and lesser critters.
There's all kinds of stuff out there. There's all kinds of stuff there. There are whole realities that are purely electrical or mathematical or musical, and I know people who are working in them. Mm-hmm. Believe me. You can have a transmutation. You don't have to stay in one. You can multitask, and part of that is the fact that we are inherently transcendent right now. We're inherently immortal right now. And a lot of that gets unleashed as your awareness broadens once you're out of the body.
Right, right. Wow. And also in that same chapter, you have contact. It's great for the soul, yours and the dead's. Why is contact with the dead good for us and them?
You know, there's so much to say about that. I don't know if you've got an hour or two. Let me just talk about Alan Botkin for a minute, who has uncovered a way of inducing after death communication as a therapy, and he uses eye movement techniques and sometimes lights, and there are these therapists now even here in Germany, all over the United States, and they work with people to get a person have communication, and the person who comes through is always the person they most need to communicate with. And in one session, now the communication, the actual time of communication lasts from 5 to 20 seconds. During that, but it could, the therapy itself could take maybe 2 hours to get the person into it. And this is the power of direct communication, which is why when I work as a medium, I try to get people to do it. I try to train them while we're on the phone or certainly in workshops. And believe it or not, the workshops are coming up to 100% success for people communicating. But let's go back to Botkin. People who have suffered for decades from Vietnam War with a post-traumatic stress disorder that's death-related, nightmares, intrusive memories, depression, suicidal longing, it is gone in 20 seconds.
Wow. Yeah, and you even had an incident that you say, I can't remember what chapter it was in, but you personally, do you mind talking about that experience that you had that you the peel off, what you term as the peel off.
Right. Oh, good for you. Yes, that was quite amazing. I had been carrying this dead baby for a long time. And part of that was one of the reasons why I went into this field more intensely than other fields anyway is because of this intensity of mourning that I was born into. And the dead brother, the dead baby, I am also that brother, but he's also himself. And I carried him. My mother carried him. And until this man, Peter, the great love of my life, he died in 1975, came and took it, just lifted it out of my body. And this to me is, when you see this kind of thing happen, and I think I also talked about this woman who's, was it her husband, I don't remember, who came to her at night and took manacles off of her hand, her wrists, and he de-slaved her. It's not a verb, but I'm using it as a verb. He completely removed all the elements of her enslavement, which had come from past lives and he knew about, et cetera, and so forth, but it was were also enacted in this life, in her living for everybody else, and fear
right.
of being selfish. And that changed her.
The dead can heal.
Oh, better than almost anything. They are the best therapists without a doubt on the face of the earth.
And can we heal them if they have...
Absolutely, absolutely. And we do so all the time. We do it in our thoughts. We don't realize how much of our thinking gets projected outward. We do it in our thoughts. We do it in our dreams. We rescue them. We talk to them. We help them move on. You know, most of the dead are pretty happy people, and they feel very liberated. They don't all get it right away either. Some of them don't even really know how to manipulate their bodies that well yet. But there are a great many who are in remorse or who are stuck or who are afraid to meet other dead people. And sometimes the other dead people will come in and ask for my help during a session or sometimes when I'm alone to make contact with a resisting dead person. And once that starts to open up, then the healing for the dead happens. So not only do we help a dead person directly in our dreams, primarily in our unconscious levels of life, but also we help the fairly healthy dead to make contact with other dead who are in bad condition.
Right.
And that can, once that comes into play, if you can get a husband and wife together, for instance, not that happens so often, because very often they don't have that much to do with each other, a husband and wife, believe it or not. But sometimes there is a big bond there, and they come together, and you start to watch, or I get reports back, that the whole family seems to have shifted. The living side of the family starts to shift.
Wow.
We are in contact. Yeah.
So I know, like, one of your things is, like, you say all the time, Julia, that we have the ability to do this, what you do so well, that we all have this ability, and I just, how do we get there?
You are there.
Well, I mean, but it feels like I haven't, you know, I mean, just me personally, I mean, I know lots of people that do make contact, but what is, you know, and I know in somewhere in the book you said, some people don't make contact because they're too much in grief, but other times that's when they do make contact. Is there like a list that we need to follow or what? I don't know.
Well, on my website and in the book, I have the shorter versions on the website, how to make contact, which is based on strong intention. And without strong intention, you're not going to get anywhere, because without strong intention, you're not going to emit the strength of an electromagnetic field or the enzymes that you need. I know I'm sounding pretty weird. I am weird. That you need to actually thicken the field enough to create communication. The main block for us, of course, is the fear that it's just our imaginations. We can't tell whether it's real or not. And believe it or not, even professionals go through that. I remember one time I had a lot riding on a reading for somebody. She was doing a lot of publicity for me or hadn't done it yet, and she wanted to contact someone, and I was worried about it. And the dead person came in. I'd never met him. I didn't even, never met the woman I was doing the reading for either. And he said, "Come on, Julia, you know this stuff is real." And you cannot imagine what came through in this reading, the detail and directions that this woman was supposed to take with her business and stuff like that. It was just amazing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
But it's hard. A lot of what goes on, even professionally, especially with this gallery-style mediumship, where they go, you know, I'm getting a Robert over in this corner, or whatever it is, a lot of that is just pure telepathy, and the actual presence of the dead is not there. But they can still tap into something. But a lot of it is that you're tapping into the living to discover who the dead person was. When the dead are really present, you feel them. And that is something that I really work on with students or with clients on the phone, is to get people to feel that electrical zing that happens when they arrive. And people do feel it. They feel it almost immediately.
Are there any
And that will surge when there's an emotional peak, or and it surges when the answer is right. And so you can actually, it's an information condition as well, this tingling that I write about in the book.
Right. And you say you need to thicken, I guess you're referring to the atmosphere, in order to make contact easier. Are there any items or devices that you think help in this manner?
Well, a lot of humidity isn't great. I also feel that darkness helps. It's more of your emotional climate. And as soon as you start to tap into your emotional climate, things get thicker right away. If the emotion isn't there, the need isn't there. I mean, if you just want to say, I want to know how Uncle Harry's doing, that's not probably going to do a whole lot unless Uncle Harry's really determined.
Right.
So the need actually will thicken the energy itself. There are techniques that you can use that will do it. It's just bring up enough energy into your body and just imagine the room feeling thicker. And if you work in groups, you'll actually start to see smoky-type stuff in the air.
Yeah.
But the most important thing is your genuine motivation and to proceed with your deepest emotion, whether it's rage, abandonment, love, doesn't matter what it is, but you go from your honesty forward.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The other thing, Karen, I just want to mention too, the other important thing is that when you have a picture of the dead person as that dead person is now, not as that dead person was, not in the photograph or on the deathbed, God forbid, you try to fix on that picture inside of your mind until you feel that you've got that person's attention. This is when you have brainwave synchronicity. And until that happens, there's going to be disturbance. Once you make that connection and you've got that other person's attention, which means that he or she has got yours as well, then it'll proceed. The telepathy will start to flow.
Hmm. Okay. And
it's not hard. You're always getting people's attention in everyday life. You know how to do it.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, as a big-mouthed Italian girl, I know how to do it, but...
I've done it spontaneously with people, you know, talking to someone who's passed over and just kind of like, oh, and now he's saying this and now, you know, and I just kind of fall into it very easily, but I can't always just do that. It's just sometimes I guess I just have to start paying more attention.
But do you need to always do it? It sounds like that's just fine.
No, I didn't mean I always want to do it. I just meant at will, I suppose, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It just seems to accidentally come around sometimes, that's all.
Yeah, when the condition, there has to be a certain psychological climate to make it work. And the important thing about a professional medium, I don't mean really that. I'm going to take that back. But people who've got big fields, I know plenty of people who are not professional who are extraordinarily mediumistic and they've never really even used it, for instance. As long as you can pull that field off, you can be pretty sure you're going to get something.
Right.
There are some people, for instance, that I worked with who want to talk to somebody. They say they want to contact someone, but the truth is what they want is to challenge me.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And that never works. Nobody
Jeez.
Shows up. Yeah. It's very difficult stuff.
Gee, what a waste
of time. There's plenty of them out there.
I'm sure. It must be a double-edged sword for you to have this ability, Julia. Is it like, because I don't know. I don't know if I'd want to see dead people and all this. Like, when you wake, for instance, when's the last time you saw a dead person?
2 hours ago.
I thought you were going to say, I don't know, a month ago.
No, I do this all the time. I work, I do a lot of readings, and it never fails that dead people show up at this point. Even
right.
if that's not what people intend, they still show up.
So have you ever dealt with an angry dead person?
Resentful, yeah. Angry, yes. I ran into a policeman once on the street in Sausalito in California. A cop who had just been shot to death. And the odd thing was that his friend was standing there in the parking lot and started to tell me the story about this dead cop just minutes after I ran into him. He was enraged by what had happened, resentful. that he left these two little children behind, that he was just starting this great career and blah, blah. The only thing that could happen here was his uncle showed up, a beloved uncle, and took over. And I just stayed until... to see this guy starting to accept what had happened to him. Yes, angry, resentful, yeah, sure.
Jeez, right. And, I mean, what can you do at that point? I'm sure he's glad you can, those people are glad you can see them. But, I mean, when they say, oh, you send them to the light, I mean, is that something that is actually done or can be done?
Forget that. That doesn't do anything. No, I see so many people say, oh, we prayed and did this for her light, and I check in, and that person's in terrible shape. They don't get anywhere near that light.
Oh, no.
No. Well, it's a nice idea, and certainly it's a lot better than sending nasty thoughts.
Right.
But it doesn't mean it's ever going to really reach the person. Again, you have to have really strong intention to reach the person.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean a burning intention. I just mean a deep, concentrated focus.
Right,
that's all.
Right.
And that's
yeah.
what makes a person professional, when they can pull that focus whenever they need to.
Mm-hmm. Do people come to you out of nowhere to talk to you, dead people?
All the time.
Oh, God.
And
how do you turn them off?
Even funnier, the people where if you sit down in a bus stop or something and some woman sits down next to you and just starts to talk about her dead mother, and
mm-hmm.
I'm watching the dead mother stand there and try to tell me to get this woman to get her leg checked out or something like that all the time. It happens a lot in restaurants for me.
Oh.
When everyone is kind of open.
Right.
And then it can be quite jolly.
Yeah.
So is the process of going into the light an actual process, or is that just something we've, kind of made up?
Yeah, well, we're light fixated because we're so afraid of dark. There is a luminous light. There is. It's conscious. I call it the presence. It's an aspect of the divine. But I mean, I'm certainly not putting down light or all of that. And people do experience light. Doesn't mean they stay there. There's always something to be done on the other side of that. There's a great deal of euphoria often shortly after a death, or a person can emerge into the light or whatever. But then there's a certain point where, again, where they return to get some work done or to experience something or to be creative about something or to examine something, and they start to move again with form. And that sort of thing can go on for centuries in our terms. This is sort of examination and creativity and exploration. There are points when people get way out there and actually stop being people in the way that we understand it.
Hmm.
They start to actually spawn human souls.
Why do people need to come back to Earth as opposed to learning everything they can learn on the other side? Because it seems like they can
Well, you can't learn about physical experience on the other side. You can't.
Right.
And we're here, we're manifesting physical reality. And that's a whole level of reality. There are atoms in other dimensions. There are atoms, there are molecules, there's enzymes, there's chlorophyll, there's all kinds of things in other dimensions. But what we're here for is what a baby's here for. When you see a baby go over to a table leg, crawl over to a table leg, wrap its tongue around the table leg in fascination, that's why we're here.
Mm-hmm.
That baby's created that table leg. And if you're in that room, you've created another table leg. The only reason why it seems to be the same table leg is because that baby eventually becomes trained to agree with you. And part of what being here is about the limitation. But it isn't true in terms of reincarnation that you incarnate, then you die, then you leave the afterlife and incarnate again. That's not how it works. This is all simultaneous. Who you are, your ego, everything else survives, and it's eternal and will take its own path. Your incarnations are a part of you. And basically, you are all really the same person. But each of us goes out, and this is true also of probable selves, goes out into different directions, different emotional, psychological climates, different areas of exploration and creativity. And that information and body of experience becomes part of all of you on the deeper levels. And that's what this is about. It's a coordinated effort among all of our incarnations and also among our parallel selves and our probable selves. It doesn't end. Consciousness doesn't stop. There is nothing that stops it. It just keeps creating over and over in different ways. It doesn't even respect what we understand as death.
But it
doesn't care about what we think death is. It does other things. Consciousness is just, it's beyond belief. And the maturity, the spiritual maturity, is about being aware of all these aspects, all these kinds of creativities, all these kinds of explorations and experiments. The more aware we are of them, the more we contain, the more expanded we are, and that is what it means to be made in the likeness of God.
So, Julia, what would you say, like, you know, your life, we all have different life purposes, is that correct?
Yes, we do.
Okay, so... Do you think your purpose is to get people to communicate with the dead and understand why it's a good thing, or what is your purpose?
I'm certainly part of breaking down the limitations of communication. I'm working with, you know, when I was in my, sort of late 70s, I had an out-of-body experience. I now understand where I projected into the future, and met my future incarnation, and his name is Bernard. And he just looked at me and said, "Ah, you finally figured it out, huh?" Really nasty. Mm. But it just goes to show that no matter how well we do, we're really Stone Age. Not that I should put the Stone Age down, but you understand what I mean.
Yeah.
And
he
already is aware and can see projections. He can just see them, and he can interact with them. He also had some kind of device, could be partly technology, that communicated with other dimensions. So, again, we're not talking about afterlife, right?
Yeah, you're talking about something Hello? That's going on right now. Yes.
Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah. We're not talking about the afterlife. We're talking about interdimensional communication in which the afterlife is mixed in. Can you hear
right.
me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes, but it sounds suddenly just absolutely dead. And so I think I'm part of his pull. In other words, I'm working with him 200 years from now.
Right.
And there's a lot of us doing it. And it isn't just about the whole communication system, the whole technology that we live with now is also furthering this at tremendous speeds. We absorb enormous amount of electrical impulses now from all the machinery, from the cell phone that we have or whatever phones we're using right now. We absorb it in a rate that has never been known. And all perception is about electrical impulses, all perception, whether it's hearing, smell, touch, it all ultimately is electrical.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are, because of this training through our technology, we are beginning, more and more of us are beginning to perceive finer levels of reality through these electrical, because we can perceive subtler electrical impulses. I find it fascinating. And technology is our art, and art really is what always pulls humanity forward.
Right, exactly, Julia. So, you know, are you living simultaneous lives right now as you sit there?
Totally.
Okay. So what some
as you
might
sit,
consider...
As you sit, if you're sitting, as you sit there too, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally you can see them, you can experience them. I've experienced 6 of them simultaneously at one time and experienced the body changes. You can.
But you can't really operate
living that way.
No, I would assume. I was going to say that must have been a hell of a day.
It was. It was memorable. It was memorable, believe me.
We have a caller, actually, named Lisa on the line here, and I'm going to bring her on. She's had 2 near-death experiences, and she wanted to ask a question, if that's okay with you, Julia.
Sure.
Okay. Hi, Lisa. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Lisa.
Hello, everybody. My question is, I'm under a lot of stress right now, and the last few nights, and generally I kind of get this feeling around a full moon or a new moon. My dreams are very vivid, but at this point, because of the level of stress, I've had like moments where I felt I was in that same spot I was before I decided to come back. And 2 of my near-death experiences, once I was
They were not good spots,
place.
Or they were... Were they
I
not good spots?
Place. I'm sorry, say that once again.
Were you talked? You referred to being in the same place as you were in the near-death experiences. Can you describe that?
With my... I died while giving birth. Apparently, I don't remember it, other than the feeling of warmth, and I was ready to let go. I was giving birth to my son, and my dad, who had died 30 days prior to that, told me, no, go back.
Okay, and you said that you're experiencing this now again, this feeling of warmth?
Well, yeah, it's this warm feeling. I never saw a light. I just felt my body give way. Like I was totally disconnected from my body during the trauma. And then the first one, I was stabbed and through my back, near my heart. And that one was more painful. So the first part of my dream is always this real strict, painful feeling. And then when I let go of my body, I'm okay. I can deal with it. And the stress I'm having is financial. Well, and I feel guilt.
Mm-hmm.
I feel guilt for not dying, and I feel guilt for being present.
How can I help you? What's it?
The guilt is this guilty feeling. Is this, why should I feel guilty? I came back. I feel they're more of a life purpose. Why would these dreams be not dreams, but more of a reaction to, the word is reaction. Why would stress bring these memories back? These particular memories.
Because it's associative, yeah. It's associative. And you go back to, it's like when someone dies, you fast forward to the worst possible moment in the future. It's an associative thing. The subconscious, there's no time to the unconscious or the superconscious, I'd rather call it. And it finds associations. So that's not to worry. But my basic feeling is that if you had some regression therapy, especially around the stabbing,
mm-hmm.
my feeling is that you heard and created certain beliefs at that time that have created a post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah,
and this is what keeps coming back to you. And if you can get back to that moment of stabbing, and I'm sure when you were 4-5 years of age, some bad stuff happened then too. And that should be dug out. That's the basis of your real fear, your instability.
Oh my God.
And you learned as a child to leave your body to avoid things. Yeah. Don't tell me, because Lisa, I wouldn't believe you if you did. Don't tell me you don't regard your body as an item of punishment. This is how it was held in your family. So this is what's going on. You leave it. You leave your body. And the warmth is fine. Don't worry about dying. That's the one thing. Don't worry about dying. We all feel this warmth.
Sure.
This warmth is right there, right adjacent to us. It's just a matter of opening up. People feel that kind of warmth often in the mornings when they're coming out of sleep. And there's that cozy, loving, warm feeling that's always present. That is part of the divine tissue we live in. Enjoy that part. And let your punishment release and melt into it. It'll take it away.
Okay. All right.
Thanks for calling, Lisa.
Thank you.
All right, take it easy. Okay, yeah. Yeah, I mean, just like you said, I mean, we do things, you know, she might be leaving her body, just as you said, to, she knew she had to get out of that body in order to avoid hurting more, you know? And
absolutely.
I wonder if that's why, like someone in the chat room said, if that's why some people astral travel, at, you know, unwillingly or at times, you know, you want to get the hell out of there, you know?
That's an old Jungian idea, unfortunately, and it really, I don't agree with it. There are certain kinds of pressures and stresses that get relieved in dreams, chemical excesses, chemical buildups, and stuff like that, that can help propel projection, absolutely. But it isn't really an avoidance. It's a balancing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And my view, the out-of-body experiences are probably the people who know the most about reality.
And I want to mention to the listeners that in Julia's book, The Last Frontier, on her website, which is www.juliaasante.com, you can read Chapter 14 for free. So if you guys are thinking about buying the book, it's certainly a keeper. I mean, it's got so much information in here. But Chapter 14 is Ghosts, Thought Forms, and Earthbound Spirits. Like I said, if you go to our website, you can download that for free or read it right on the site. And if you like it, get the whole book by all means. So when you talk about thought forms, earthbound spirits, and ghosts, what I'm going to do, Julia, is take a tiny break, but can we talk about those things when we come back?
Yes, we can. Absolutely.
Okay, so you guys, we'll be back in just a couple minutes. Thank you.
Visit purpleplates.com today. For over 40 years, the Purple Energy Plates have been delivering amazing results for their many customers. Inspired by the great genius Nikola Tesla, the harmony, healing, and energetic effects of the plates have proven over and over to be beneficial and often miraculous to thousands of customers. With their money-back guarantee and the many benefits, how can you afford not to get one? Check their site for daily specials and choose from their many energy products. You won't be sorry. Visit them today at purpleplates.com for mind, body, and spirit. And expect them.
And we are back. That was Concrete Blonde doing Everybody Knows, which was originally by Leonard Cohen. It's a great song. He's such a great lyricist. So welcome back, Julia.
Thank you.
And, okay, so let's talk about these, you know, I've heard of thought forms. We create them from fear. Is that true?
We create them all the time, not necessarily just from fear. Thought forms are in their own way conscious. I mean, all energy is conscious, yeah? And they aggregate with other thought forms and build in power.
Right.
So that if you have a situation like World War II and you have a situation like Nazi Germany, you're seeing a creation of thought forms that became so strong that they were inescapable.
Right. So they're still there, you mean?
Well, to some degree, yeah. In certain places, it's quite dense. And God love the Germans, they're really still trying to work it out, which is not true of France or Italy or Austria or Japan.
Hmm.
They're still working it through here, which is great.
Well, I heard there was a playground where Hitler had his main bunker, whatever it's called, that there's now a playground there. And I thought that was curious, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But so what's the difference?
They're very conscious of what they're doing about it.
Really? Okay.
Mm,
well,
very.
You should know. You've been living there for how long now?
Well, I don't just live here. That's the thing. I touch down here a lot.
Okay.
I'm in
and
the
I know
States a lot. I'm in France. I'm in Austria. I work a great deal in Austria. So I'm not home
right.
a lot.
Right. So the difference in Chapter 14, ghosts, thought forms, and earthbound spirits, what is the difference between, like, what constitutes a ghost, for instance?
Obsessive, compulsive thought form. That's conscious. Not remarkably self-conscious, but conscious. ghosts do have repetitive actions. They're sort of caught in obsessive-compulsive thought process. You know, that's what
mm-hmm.
makes them. And these things are often thrown off by us. We sort of give birth to them. So we let go of them. In the same way, you can see things that seem like a ghost or are almost identical to a ghost that are just strong emotional imprints that are still that still endure. These are other sort of ghost type things where people would call it a ghost anyway, an apparition of some sort. But some of these ghosts can be extraordinarily developed, but they are not the dead. There's a difference. They don't seek attention. They avoid attention. The dead don't do that.
Okay.
Generally, and ghosts don't ask for help. No, they're very preoccupied. They're self-absorbed. They're in their own worlds. And the dead, if the dead are troubled, they will try to get your attention. The ghost will never try to get your attention, or almost never. It's hard to tell sometimes whether they are trying to get your attention or they're just exhibiting anger. Mostly ghosts have a lot to do with what we would call perhaps negative emotions, you know, resentments, being cheated or betrayed or murdered or whatever it is. This complex of thoughts getting thrown off, often at death. So if you've got a ghost, you're working with a ghost that's slamming doors or raising a bed, even with people in it. You might be getting someone who was a ghost who's a little bit angry and menacing, but they don't hurt you. What hurts you is your own fear.
Okay.
And poltergeists and ghosts are also not the same thing.
Mm.
There can be some, ghosts can have poltergeist activity. The dead can also do poltergeist activity. I've seen some spectacular stuff in my own homes. But generally, poltergeist very often is a whole complex of repressed feelings of somebody usually going through puberty, and they get projected out.
Hmm. Right.
That's usually the case of a poltergeist.
Right. So when people say things like, oh, I think there's a demonic activity in my house, and, you know, point to this kind of, you know, devilry, do you say that, what do you think about that? I mean, do you think that doesn't exist, or that we sometimes make it exist, like you just said, maybe?
There was a time in Canada where I worked on a house where I saw devils. And the person who I was married to at the time, I worked with, he saw the same exact thing. And there was sort of like a chief one that came out of a closet when we opened it.
Mm.
The horns, the whole business. Yeah.
What? Jeez.
Now, these people who lived there were absolutely terrified. I was able to locate where these thought forms had come from, of an old drunk who used to live on a farm that was behind the house, mm-hmm. and he generated them, but they were in some sense real. Now, the odd thing is this tortured these people, but these people also had a very, very dysfunctional family, and they were looking for something outside of themselves to blame. Now, Ron, my husband at the time, and I, when we left that house after working on it for 6 hours, we got in the car, and we had five of these little guys, not the big devil, but five of these little gremlin-type laughing little demons in the car with us.
Oh, my God.
And the truth is, I mean, I thought they were cute, and none of it really scared me, so they had no effect on me whatsoever. But on these people, on this family, yes. But this family was not honest. They had a lot of problems they were hiding. And that was really why these thought forms were fed where they lived. These thought forms that had come through this suicidal, depressed drunk who had lived there for 40 years. He was dead by then.
So the thought forms or whatever the guy was projecting, the devils, they were feeding off the negativity of the family?
Yeah, the confusion
okay.
and the anger, all this hidden stuff. The more of this stuff is hidden, the more power it has.
So how did you get rid of the freeloaders in your back seat?
By enjoying them.
Okay, and then they're like, oh,
really?
We're not
we
scared.
Enjoyed them, yeah. We thought they were adorable. Yeah. Yeah, it's not, it hasn't always been so. There was one time, for some reason, the Mensa Society asked me to ghost bust. I hate that term. I always call it ghost liberating. Ghost bust a place in the Bronx where these people were having experiences of doors slamming and things crashing to the ground and stuff like that. Nobody knew what it was. So I was, I was really, really a greenhorn at that time. And I went up there. These were people that were attached to the research that was done with me on telepathy and remote viewing. And so I went up to this place in the Bronx, and I had everybody orderly sit down on the landing upstairs because I felt it upstairs. And I had all these Mensa people sit on the floor and do their meditation thing because I didn't know what else to do.
Right.
And it was probably a good idea to keep them sort of out of the way. And I knew where this thing was. It was in a closet. And you cannot imagine. I hid it all. But you cannot imagine how my hand was shaking when I was going to open that closet door.
Ooh, gee.
I was in a state of absolute terror.
I would have
and
been
I opened
too.
It. Well, now I wouldn't be. But I opened it, and this little spark of light came out. Just so like a little spark of light. It's not a sphere, but a spark of light. And I went over and sat down, because it went over towards the meditators, the Mensa meditators, and I sat down in my place. The researcher was on to my right, and this little thing got to me, and I invited it in my body, which is how I often get rid of ghosts and other things. Or bring them in. And it's just an instinct. I don't recommend it to everyone. You have to have a really strong identity to do something like that. And it wreaked havoc. I thought I was having a heart attack. My eyelids were fluttering. My thorax was fluttering. My whole body seemed like it was just like jelly shaking all over the place. And it was like a moth in a jar, you know, beating against me on the inside of my body.
Yeah.
And I was very calm, and I thought, gee, I wonder if I'm going to die. Just thinking like that. And then I said to myself, if I just touch the researcher next to me, I'll be all right. And I couldn't. I couldn't move. So what I decided to do instead was to, I was paralyzed, was to build enough energy up to let this thing get up and out and go wherever it needs to go. And that's exactly what I did. I mustered all of this energy. I pulled and pulled, and I just shot it up out of the top of my head. At that moment, the researchers started taking photographs.
Oh.
Now, what was interesting was two things. She said to me that there was a point where she wanted to touch me. And as she put her hand out, something grabbed her hand and bent it back, and she became paralyzed.
Oh.
Then there was a certain point where the paralysis stopped, and she grabbed the camera and started taking photographs. And the photographs showed, coming out of the top of my head, three puffs of light, which was the trail this little thing made. I have, to this day, no idea what that was.
Jeez. Well, I certainly
wouldn't
invite
anything. So that's
an
instance where I really was afraid. You know, in the process, I lost the fear. That's what always happens. When you're in the process, the fear just goes. It doesn't matter. Nothing matters.
Right. And people always, you know, talk about protecting themselves from this sort of thing, even though you're in
the
midst.
It drives me crazy. All the time. And I think if we spent that much time protecting ourselves, first of all, a lot of this is American. There's a tremendous amount of paranoia in America about illness and death and terrorism and demons. I mean, you don't find this worry about the devil in Europe. It's just not here. So all of that is operating at very high levels in the United States, which is a terrible, terrible shame. And probably one of the reasons why Americans tend to be so conservative or even often backwards, retreating into old systems as a method of protection, which is not needed.
Okay. Like I said earlier, Julia, I got a reading from you, and it was unlike any other reading I've ever gotten. And I wanted to talk to you more about my reading afterwards. Of course, I never got around to it. But you have graciously agreed to do a reading on someone today, and that someone will be Karen, if that's okay with you.
Oh, you mean now?
Yeah, just like a short little reading. Is that not good?
Well, we can try it.
Okay. Karen.
Don't forget, it's 1:15 in the morning for me.
Okay. Karen,
it'll
are you there?
It'll be a creepy reading.
Okay. Do you want to say, does she
and
have
by
to
the
ask
way, also,
question?
I want to mention that the phone breaks up on my end a lot, or I hear a lot when you're speaking. I hear a lot of interference.
Okay. I'm going to mute my microphone, and Karen, go ahead and talk to Julia.
Okay, do you need to know anything, Julia?
Well, I don't know. You just want me to just start?
Whatever feels comfortable for you. I don't have an agenda.
Mm-hmm.
I have many people on the other side, and I'm aware of some of them some of the time. I could say that.
Yeah. Well, okay, we can do that, but I'm very interested in what's going on in the next 3 months for you.
Okay.
Because it feels like you're in a process of a very big change.
Huh.
And it looks like something where there's going to be a lot of fast decisions made at the end of 3 months. There's very clearly also a woman, slightly overweight, very white hair around you. I don't know if you're aware of her. She seems to have almost a storybook element to her. And when I You know, you could, what we could do is to shorten this or to make this a little bit more specific for our listeners is for you to ask me a question.
Can I ask you about the 3 months, the change? Or do you want me to ask about a person?
I don't care. I mean, I think you're going to be going through a lot of hormonal shifts.
Again?
Yes. And that is something that's been a big life project for you anyway, is to try to get some way for your hormonal system to work so that you can keep moving at a certain reliable pace.
Mm-hmm.
I see also a lot of writing projects for you coming up as well.
Oh, good.
And expansion in that area. And I don't want you to underestimate your research abilities either. You're actually quite tenacious.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that is quite a good talent and will lead you in a lot of very interesting places. And because of your personable nature, you are amenable to so many people, and they will allow you to enter into their territories of knowledge very, very quickly.
Hmm.
You really have a lot of charm.
All right, I had to unmute myself at that comment. No.
Oh. Of course you did.
Karen had a, Julia, Karen had a dalliance with this man a long time ago in the 70s. Do you see anyone like that around her?
A man from the 70s?
Yeah. Was it the 70s or the
60s? You mean with sideburns or and long hair or something? Is he dead, you mean?
Yeah, I don't believe he's dead.
You think he's dead?
I don't think so.
So you're thinking maybe that he is sort of emotionally still allied with you?
Or yes.
Still in your, is that
yes.
What you're thinking?
Yes.
What's his name?
Bruce.
Well, there's no doubt he's wondered where you are. And there's no doubt about that. And there's no doubt that the two of you work a little bit like dyads, you know, you're sort of two points at the end of each end of a pole, like two polar points. So you keep track of each other unconsciously. Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Interesting.
And you know that, Karen. Come on.
I do. I just
yeah.
Didn't
and he's
know
doing I'm the sure. same thing. What I'm trying to figure out was where the avoidance was back in the 70s. So let me look at that for a second. First of all, I see Bruce as somebody who has a high degree of emotional energy, and that frightens him. So he mm-hmm. sort of seems to be always trying to run, keep ahead of his emotional life, which is something he's never really been able to do. By the way, at this point in time, I don't see him as being dead at all. At this point in time, there's a sense of a lot of defeat in his life.
Defeat?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I don't think you would have been at all happy with this man.
Mm.
And I think you both knew that. What I see from him more than anything was this fear of his own emotions and what got churned up for him around you, that he felt as though he was losing his identity around you.
That makes sense.
Yeah, he really had very little sense of control or any faith in his ability to control things. And that would have made you crazy, because what he tends to do with that is to mope and brood.
Mm.
And he's done a lot of that since you've known him.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
There's a good thing. You're still tracking each other. There's still an alliance there. I'm certain that this is not your first time around. And this is what you often see with past or future life connections, is that people come together very powerfully and then split up again.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what I'm seeing here.
Hmm.
You have
yes.
been brother and sister? in another life. And I get the feeling right away that you don't like that, or you don't agree with that, or you don't believe that. There's a sense of almost like resistance that I got from you when I said that.
Really?
But this is not your first time, and you were meant to meet each other, and you will always track each other, because in a lot of ways, you're part of each other.
Hmm.
You may never see him again, though, Karen.
Yeah, I don't think I will.
No. But it won't matter, really.
It never would have worked. It just never
no.
would. I mean, you're absolutely right
no.
on that, even though at the
no.
time, you know, I thought, you know, love conquers all, but...
Right. Oh, it certainly does, doesn't it? can conquer a good life, too.
Uh-huh.
No, it's a good thing that, that this was dropped. This was never part of your plan anyway.
Mm.
You know, you've got a peculiar relationship with freedom.
How so?
Something that you deeply desire, and... You keep getting yourself caught in situations that usually. I mean, I think as you get a few years down the road, the sense of freedom that you've been looking for will become exhilarating, and you will definitely be moving more and more in terms of your intellect, your intellectual creativity, and this I hope for you because it's very strong.
Well, I've been
right.
looking for, you know, the direction. You know, I have strong feelings and passions, but I just have not really, at this particular time, been able to harness them in a way that feels like, yeah, that's it, you know? I mean, a lot of things feel good, but...
I shouldn't be telling you this. You have had one of the most dreadful past lives that I've ever seen, and that was that you died multiple stabbings from several people. Because of this thing, there's still an imprint or a memory of that that you carry with you in this life, which has created a lot of disjunctures in your body. In other words, that your body has a lot of different parts that don't necessarily speak to each other in the level of harmony you would like.
Huh.
So a lot of your life has been trying to harmonize that energy. And this is, again, coming back to the hormonal situation. If you did possibly past life therapy, you might hit that past life and get rid of it. And that'll really help you move a lot faster.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wanted to say that, and that's very personal, but it's so apparent, it's so clear to me, and especially on the right shoulder, a lot of damage.
Well, that's what's been hurting me for 2 days, because I fell on it the other day. And
uh-huh.
Like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, our actions do mimic our inner worlds.
Yeah.
They realize our inner worlds, yeah.
So
Jeez.
Would it be good for me to... you know, try to go into that life on my own and remember, or?
No, don't do it on your own. It's too traumatic.
Okay.
That's traumatic.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you need somebody who will slow it down, slow the process down, and make you really work. I can do it, by the way, even through Skype, but I'm very, very busy at the moment, but there are, I'm sure, lots of people around. You're in California?
Yeah.
Forget it. They're all over the place. And so somebody who knows how to slow it down so that you don't miss anything, you don't avoid anything and go through the whole process, because when we're in high levels of trauma, we have no borders and absorb every telepathic thought. If a little girl is getting raped and the person who's raping this little girl is thinking that she's a whore, you know, you're dirty, that's what this little girl is going to grow up with, and she will probably become a prostitute.
Mm-hmm.
So we, you know, they're like commands. One thing that you can do, and I recommend this to anyone, and I do it routinely, is to project yourself to your deathbed in this life
mm-hmm.
and look back on your life as though it were already lived,
mm-hmm.
and assess the fears, the strengths, the creative turns, the turns that you didn't make, the places where the love was held back, and just make an assessment of all of that. As you do it, you will also simultaneously understand why something was blocked. And you'll begin to see the resistance and the fear for what it is, just an idea.
Okay.
Very little, very small. And this one thing that you see over and over again when people die is the things that they worried about were so unimportant. Even the death process wasn't important at the end.
Right. Right.
You know, it's just like they got a flu and they recovered. Stop thinking about it.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter. I'm here. I'm fine. It's a good practice for anybody to think in terms of eternity and to say, is this important in the face of my eternal self?
Yeah.
And so much stress can come off just from that thought. What's really important? What really is meaningful to us? How do we fulfill our deepest desires, our deepest needs? And almost always, is this about creativity and not about learning lessons, which is really an American mentality.
Hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, Julia, we have just a couple of minutes left, and do you want to say anything about upcoming appearances or anything like that?
Well, unless you're in Vienna, I'm going to be doing most of my... I have a giant workshop that goes on for 10 weekends.
Wow.
In which I teach the whole thing. I teach remote viewing. I teach the medical intuitive work, which is really, really valuable and something that we can all do is to actually x-ray through a body, which, Karen, I would have done with you if we were private.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would have just gone through your body, and this tells so much about your major issues and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I'm mostly concentrated on that. I have a couple of workshops coming up, and will be in England. So I'm mostly over Europe this until... perhaps late spring.
Okay. And if anyone wants to see your whereabouts, they can visit your website and find out. That, again, is JuliaAssante, ASSANTE.com. And you guys can read that chapter 14, which I've already read. And believe me, it's just so intriguing, so amazing.
The one chapter that probably doesn't fit in the book.
Right,
it's really an aside, but it had to be written because of this idea of earthbound spirits is so sad.
Yeah, right. I just want to say again, Julia, thank you so very much for sharing your time with us and your knowledge, and you're just really one of a kind, and thank you so very much.
And thank you.
It was a great pleasure connecting with you again, and the two of you, really. And thank you for inviting me on.
Oh, sure, sure.
Thank you.
Okay, so we will see you guys next time, and have a good night and take care of each other. Thank you.
But I have to see the matter to you.